I am Plot on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Paul McAllister had a lifelong dream to publish a children's story. He shopped it around to publishers in and around Atlantic Canada, but he soon realized he could do it himself. There and Back Again, A Herman Tale, which was illustrated with Emily Brown, was published in 2014. And soon, other authors and illustrators sought to realize their own dreams, and Monster House Publishing was born. Paul joins me now, and I'll get him to tell us his story about creating this publishing house and what he wants to accomplish. He also shares his personal story of growing up with ADHD and dysgraphia. I'll also ask Paul about publishing from that side of the country and what young readers want. The website for more is at monsterhousepublishing.com. We talked last month with Paul joining me from Fredericton, New Brunswick. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Paul McAllister. Mr. McAllister, good morning.
Morning, how are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Oh, I'm doing just wonderful.
It's a great name for a company, Monster House Publishing, and it's based in Fredericton, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. I honestly don't know how we lucked out on that one, but quite happy to have the name. You know, I feel it summarizes who we are quite well.
Yeah, well, did you grow up in New Brunswick?
Yeah, I'm from Fredericton originally. I do have family in St. Andrews, New Brunswick, too. But, you know, classic kid from a smallish town. I grew up kind of dreaming of getting out of here. I moved to Toronto and spent some time in Toronto. A couple years, I had kind of an acting career. And then I moved out west and was in Vancouver for a while. And then I realized how great it was back here, so I scooted on back.
That's what a lot of people think about the East, especially Atlantic Canada. It's become almost I guess it's the cost of living, but it's the lifestyle too. I think it's a big draw for a lot of people, right?
It is. I mean, I don't get me wrong. I love both Toronto and Vancouver, but you get to see a full spectrum of humanity in the bigger cities, and it's not always really great. You know, there's some kind of not so great things that come with those kind of bigger cities.
Sure.
Same thing anywhere you are, right? But here where I live and was raised, you know, things seem to move a little slower, even though, you know, that's kind of all relative these days.
Yeah. But
there's trees and, you know, the ocean's right there. And you know, just that East Coast kind of hospitality is a real thing. So,
Did you grow up, I'm curious about growing up and in your relationship to reading and books. What was that like?
You know, that's a great question, because actually I grew up until I was in about grade four, I was functionally illiterate. I have kind of ADHD and dysgraphia, and I went to elementary in the 90s. So I really struggled to learn to read with kind of the way my brain's made up. I was really good at kind of sussing out what books were about by the pictures, so it wasn't until we switched to chapter books that they realized that I couldn't read. I mean, fortunately, I come from a family of educators, so I was kind of drug kicking and screaming into a love of reading. And, you know, eventually, it's honestly made me the person I am today. Like, I can't go on enough about how important reading is kind of to the development of emotional intelligence and you know, empathy and all those kind of key foundational parts of being human that allows us to live with each other well.
That's a great way to put it, because I can't tell you, you know, there are things that I have to read because of this podcast. And these are things that I probably would not have read in, you know, daily life, say. And whether or not I enjoy it, I feel better for having done it.
Well, it gives you such, like, reading is kind of unique, especially like reading a physical book, because when you're reading something that kind of immerses you into the content, you're not reading it from, you know, you almost become the person that's reading. You get to experience their experiences, and you know, you get put in the minds of so many different kind of worldviews that it's, you know, it's a game changer, you know, like, and it keeps your brain working, right? Which is, there's all the other kind of entertainment you consume kind of almost does the opposite. It just kind of like numbs you to everything. But books just spark something, you know, like.
And so you mentioned getting diagnosed with dysgraphia and ADHD. How old were you at that point?
Well, I got diagnosed with ADHD rather early, especially because it was in the 90s. So it was like probably the mid 90s. I might have been like 11 or 12. It was just when people really started being like, wait a minute, this is a thing. Mm-hmm. Dysgraphia took a while. It wasn't until I had kind of like returned home from going away and considered going to university, and I went to kind of do a psychological kind of testing to see what kind of support I could get, because I'd always struggled. You know, I graduated high school with like a 54% grade average, right? Like, I struggled. And dysgraphia came along a little later and explains, because like I just can't spell, which is kind of ironic for a publisher and an author, but it comes in handy when I go into schools and talk to kids and, you know, tell them that, like, you know, I'm standing here in front of you, I'm a 40-year-old man, I can't spell a lot of words. They still just don't stay in my brain. And, like, I just didn't let it stop me. I kept on chasing the dreams, and I asked for help when it comes to spelling. And the kids kind of, like, you know, their eyes light up because it's so relatable.
Yeah, that must be... I don't know how to describe it. When you see people light up like that, and children especially, and they realize that they're not different, or their experience is, you know, not dissimilar from someone else's, that must make you feel, I don't know, gratified maybe? Does it?
It's actually why I do this. You know, like when I was, you know, there's no such thing as a bad kid, but I was hanging around with kids that weren't in the best circumstances, and I was putting myself in circumstances that weren't great as well. And what changed for me, you know, I was kind of forced to learn to read, but it wasn't until an author came into my school. Her name's Sherry Fitch, and she's from Fredericton, New Brunswick as well, and she's done some really great kids' books like Toes in My Nose and Sleeping Dragons Everywhere, and she told us that she was from Fredericton and that we could be an author if we wanted. Mm. And that really stuck with me, you know? And, like, so every time I go into the school, I make sure to tell the kids just that. And, like, if I can just reach one of those kids to go off on a path similar to mine or even, you know, or different, but, like, chase that dream of writing and sharing their stories as opposed to kind of giving up on dreams, you know, that's, I mean, I can go to bed happy for sure. I did a reading on Wednesday, this previous Wednesday, actually, and it was the first time of reading this, you know, my new book, Planes, mm-hmm. Trains, and Monstermobiles. And afterwards, a little girl came up, and she was like, I have dysgraphia, too, you know?
Really, yeah.
It was great. Like, you just see her, like, she's excited about it, as opposed to being, like, upset that she has this kind of nuanced way her brain works. I think, you know, when people say learning disabilities, I think that's kind of a misnomer, because it's like an alternate ability,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you mentioned hearing authors, and seeing authors, pardon me, in schools growing up. I still remember authors coming to elementary school even. And
yes.
this is like 30 years ago now.
Right? It sticks with you, you know?
Yeah.
'Cause like when you pick up a book as a kid, it's such a thing that's present and it's there. And, like, the concept of it being created by someone from, like, around where you are.
Yeah.
You know, I always thought that books were written by people that lived in the big cities, you know. And that's one of the reasons why I moved to Toronto, you know, originally for acting. And but it was kind of, if you wanted to do something, if you wanted to pursue your dreams, you had to leave and you had to go someplace where those dreams were, as opposed to, like, be in the place you are and make the dreams yourself. And, you know, it makes a big difference.
Yeah. So it was about 10 years ago, was it, that you wanted to publish a book? And I understand that as you were pursuing that in conversations you were having with other publishers, it wasn't an easy road to get published. What did that experience tell you about this business, say?
Well, it was, you know, that's a really interesting question. So New Brunswick is small. Like, there's basically, like, the, you know, the size of a medium-sized city spread out entire, around the whole province. I think there's like maybe 900,000 people here.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in the arts for a very long time. And there's a publishing company called Goose Lane Editions, which I think is actually, it might still be Canada's oldest independent publishing company in Canada.
Yeah.
But I had been on an arts board with one of the women that ran the company, so I reached out to her, and I was like, hey, let's, you know, I'm checking off bucket list items, and publishing my children's book is on there. Would you have any interest in doing it? And she pointed out, she's like, we don't do kids anymore, books anymore. There's Bouton d'Or, which is a largely Francophone publishing company that does the majority of their publications are kids' books, but there's not really an Anglophone children's publishing company running right now. So she's like, you're a productive guy. You might as well just do it yourself. Mm. I think it's said that it's an interesting thing when you think about these smaller communities and you find like a hole in an industry. Like, it's not something that you would find in most places. Like, most places will have a number of children's, probably, like Nova Scotia has a few, and mm-hmm. I think even Newfoundland has one or two, but that's what's so great about kind of these communities is you can make opportunities as you see them, right? So, yeah, no, it was kind of exciting. Originally I didn't even plan on doing a publishing company. I just self-published my first book, There and Back Again, A Herman Tale. And when you go to the public, the internet will tell you whatever you want to know about anything as long as you research it properly. And I figured out how to register an ISBN, so you have to go to the Library Archives website and register an ISBN, but then you have to set up an account. And you had to have a publishing company to set up an account. So, like, right there on the spot, I just made up. It was called Herman's Monster House Publishing originally because the story was about Herman the Monster.
Yeah.
So, like, it was right off the top of my head. I had no plans of taking this to the next level. And it wasn't, I'm in the arts my whole life, and I ran a music and arts festival called Folly Fest. So I had a connection to visual artists and musicians from all around the world, and from around here predominantly, and they started to reach out and ask how I had done it. And I was like, well, why don't I help you do it? And that one thing led to another, and now we're publishing between 6 to 8 titles a year right now, and mm-hmm. I think we've got just about 30 titles under our belt. So,
yeah, it's fascinating to hear this because at that moment, other people come up to you and want to know how to do it, and then you decide to work to all work together. Specifically to your book and books, what is the relationship like in terms of collaborating with an illustrator? How did you find that? Did you have the text written first, or do you work together when you're working on a book, say?
Yeah, I'll write the text first. And the illustrator, Emily Brown, who's also from Chipman, New Brunswick. Currently, she's living in Toronto. But I didn't even know her before I wrote the first book. I just kind of put it out there on the internet that I was looking for an illustrator. And a friend, a mutual friend, connected us. And it's really great. I'm very, very fortunate because I can ramble to Emily about what I envision. And it's like she's like going into my brain and seeing it exactly, so usually what we'll do is I'll write the story down and then we'll get together and kind of go through it bit by bit and kind of talk about what we imagine for the characters, and we get really into it too, like we bury in Easter eggs for the adults and kind of have a lot of like 90s references, like the new book has Easter eggs that there's like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles Easter eggs, obviously, but there's also like little nods to The Shining and like other kind of weird, quirky, kind of spooky, elements that hopefully the parents and the adults, when they're, reading to the kids, are going to catch and kind of have a little chuckle about. So, yeah, no, it's awesome. It's a really great experience.
It'd be kind of odd, though, if a kid came up to you and said that they got The Shining reference.
I mean, I'd be like, well, it looks like your parents have a lot of faith and you're not having nightmares, but also have good taste in, well, personally, I think it's good taste in cinema, so,
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what have you found? Pardon me, Paul. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and sometimes kids do catch that stuff, too, right?
Yeah.
The third book has a lot of 90s pop punk references, and some kids are digging into that 90s kind of I guess it's retro now, which is kind of alarming. But, you know, they catch that stuff.
That says something, doesn't it, Paul, about young people in general. That you can't condescend to them, can you? I mean, they're savvier than we give them credit for.
Oh, yeah, kids are great. I mean, they're so much smarter than a lot of us kind of assume. Like, we've actually done a few programs, where young author programs, where we've published kids' stories. And you put them side by side with books written by adults, and you can't tell the difference, you know, right? Like, it's, especially with kids' books. And sometimes the kids' books that are written by kids are better because their imagination isn't kind of hindered by kind of the process of being an adult, right?
Yeah.
Like, they go out there on a limb to some wild and crazy ideas that we don't always get to.
Yeah, the possibilities are endless, aren't they, with one's imagination, and especially when you're a young person like that and haven't got the day-to-day stuff that adults have to deal with, and you're allowed to let your mind wander or ramble on as you wish.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was honestly my biggest fear growing up, was just that I would grow up and lose my imagination, because, you know, when I was a kid reading, like, Charlie Brown stuff and other books, all the parents were always kind of drags, and they talked with, like, trumpet noises, and it was a real concern. I was like, I don't want to become an adult. Like, that sounds horrible. But fortunately, like, you don't actually have to.
Yeah.
So, just keep that imagination going.
Yeah. So what have you found in terms of the business itself and what kids want to read, what young readers want to read? Are certain genres, fall into fashion, from time to time? Where we are at the end of 2024 and looking ahead to 2025, what do young people want to read?
Well, I mean, it's a complicated question, because with kids' books, like, you're dealing with two audiences, right? Because the person buying the book is 98%, 99% of the time, it's an adult, right? So you have to be catering to what the adult thinks the kids want to read, which isn't always what the kids want to read, right? So, I mean, I do find that I go into schools quite a lot, and the kids love stories about monsters. They eat the books up. But when it comes to, at the end of the day, they're like, this is the best book I wanted. And they go home, and, you know, their parents are like, so what'd you do at school today? They're like, nothing. You know, so, like, that information doesn't go the one way. So a lot of the times I find the parents are buying, we have a new book, which is an absolutely beautiful book. It's about, it's called Penny's Triumphant Turnaround, and it's all about dealing with anxiety, which is, like, such an important topic in today's, you know, it's unfortunate, but there's an epidemic of anxiety in kids right now. So parents really want to be figuring out how to deal with that. It's written by a mental health therapist, and it has some really great kind of step-by-step instructions on how to do it. Her name's Stacey McClain. She's wonderful. So that's selling really, really well. Another really top seller right now, and this, I think, is kind of one of the occasions where both the kids and the adults are seeing eye to eye, and they both want to read it, is Indigenous content.
Mm-hmm.
So we work very closely with the Indigenous communities here in New Brunswick. We work with the Wabanaki Visual Arts Program from the New Brunswick College of Craft and Design, and a partnership where we work with their students to kind of publish traditional either like knowledge keeping or legends or stories or kind of, you know, whatever they want to tell, like whatever stories they want to tell. And those are quite popular as well. So we just did a book called Mitzi's First Time Picking Sweetgrass, which is all about a kitty going with her mom to pick sweetgrass for the first time. It just kind of tells you the proper way to pick sweetgrass and how to recognize it. And yeah, so those are really kind of the books that both the kids and the parents want to read. And it's, you know, picture books.
Yeah.
Picture books, they're great. They're evergreens, right? They'll go and they'll go and they'll go. Like, the first Herman book came out 10 years ago. So some of these kids that kind of started reading Herman, they're like 20 now, you know? But they're passing down the books to their younger siblings, to their nieces and nephews. et cetera, et cetera. And so those books will just keep moving. Like, you know, I think Curious George has been in print for, what, like 70, 80 years or something like that? So, yeah, I mean, once you kind of hit a classic, it'll just keep on going.
And what was it like for you with the Herman book? Was it always a plan to write more than one?
I honestly couldn't tell you. I don't really remember. I came up with a story on the fly. It's essentially like a, you know, it's a heavily, you know, translated autobiography of my journey to kind of going and, you know, I loved what I had here, but I wanted to go out and see what it was like in other places, and I went for it, and it was challenging, and then eventually I decided I wanted to go home, and home was different, and I changed, well, I didn't change, but I just kind of adjusted and adapted to the way home was now, right? And that was kind of the big overarching story I wanted to tell. But then all of a sudden, another story was there in my mind, and another, and I mean, right now I'm kind of plotting out the next four or five Hermit adventures, so it's unlimited, right? Because you know, you have a message, you've got 15 to 1800 words. We always try to carry some sort of moral empathetic, emotional intelligence-based message within the story. So there's all sorts of things that we can be covering when we're going through these books. So, yeah, I certainly don't think I planned on writing a series when I first wrote it, but it definitely just was a natural thing to happen.
And all these titles that you've just mentioned, they're all available on the Monster House Publishing website, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're available on Monster House Publishing. You can .com. You can get them through Indigo and Chapters, Amazon. You know, you just search Monster House Publishing online, and you should find links aplenty to look at all of our titles.
So I've lived in Vancouver my whole life, and I just found out as we were talking that you'd lived in Vancouver previously. I'm always curious to know, when people who have lived here before leave, where they lived. Like, what neighborhood did you live in?
I was actually really, really lucky. I was around Commercial and Fourth. So, you know, just at the top of Commercial, well, of the kind of the more, you know, I don't know how to describe it. I don't want to say hippie-ish because that's not quite right. But, I was there 2005 and 6. I worked at Hastings Racetrack as a horseman. I walked to work often and really enjoyed the walk down Commercial. And then I'd still enjoy the walk down Hastings, but it was sometimes the walk wasn't as safe as I would have liked. But I loved the city. Like, I haven't been back since. Uh-huh. Just because, you know, we're so far away from each other, it's crazy. I remember going to work and just kind of looking out and seeing the mountains and watching, like, the clouds come and just, like, run into them. And it was, you know, it's, you know, how life just, one little random thing happens and your life takes a whole new direction. You know, if I was dating someone at the time and things didn't work out and I decided to go home for a bit and get my legs back up underneath me, and one thing led to another, and now here we are talking today, 20 years ago, or 20 years later. Yeah. But I definitely could have seen myself kind of staying there and getting to know the city more.
It's funny, because the first thing you said when you said Commercial and Fourth, that you were lucky, because I find when I ask people that question, wherever they ended up living, say, was the best place for them to have lived in Vancouver. You know what I mean? The best neighborhood, say.
Everyone's fine. I mean, each neighborhood has its own chance. I didn't get to really explore as much as I would have liked. But it definitely fit for where I was at that stage. Like, you know, I had kind of gross white boy dreads and loved to kind of hang out at the cafes, and it was perfect for me. I'm sure now I love it as well, but, like, you know, I think that's a really interesting insight that, like, anywhere someone lives in Vancouver, they're really, really lucky and happy to be there, right there, you know?
Exactly, yeah. Paul, it's been such a pleasure speaking today. All the best in all of your endeavors. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was an absolute pleasure, and I'll keep an eye out for, well, keep an ear out for upcoming episodes. Cheers. Appreciate it.
The website for more is at monsterhousepublishing.com. Paul McAllister, its founder, join me on the line from Fredericton, New Brunswick in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.